Today, the world holds its breath. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. Long time no see, mate.
Yeah, we've always been a bit busy the last 2 or 3 weeks, but I think it's really good to have a chat today. You know, next week we've got a small election going on somewhere in America, as I seem to recall. You know, I hardly noticed it, really. The markets have been up and down, and of course, next Tuesday, the Reserve Bank is going to take the rates into uncharted territory and do more quantitative easing. Other than that, it's a nice quiet day.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, I remember when we first started talking on this platform about a year ago, and we ended one of our conversations with, "May you live in interesting times," and that's certainly been the case over the last 12 months.
Yeah, and what I'm fascinated by are all the various spooky narratives that are running, right? It's really interesting just watching the, you know, a lot of the mainstream media supporting, you know, everything that's going on and being very positive about what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at the US, then you can see the polarization going on there between the two sides of politics like I think I've never seen before, I think, despite the fact that there is actually some common ground between the two parties, particularly, for example, with China and those sorts of things. And the other side of the coin is that, again, everybody's claiming that, you know, there's a big bounce back. I mean, we had the GDP number in the US looking really strong. Well, of course, it would be strong because you had such a huge fall. So the only way is up. And of course, the way they're reported, it makes it sound really up. But, you know, if you peel back the onion a bit, there are still significant issues, aren't there?
Well, if you actually like sort of get into the nitty gritty, the GDP partials, like something like 6% of the rise, so somewhere around about sort of 1/6 of the rise was driven by inventories.
Yep.
So it's driven, you know, I mean, that's like what, about 15-18% of the rise was driven by, was just driven by restocking.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, something pretty obvious that's going to happen after you see a massive issue with supply chains, with lockdowns, etc.
And of course, there was that injection into households and businesses directly from, you know, the sort of support packages that they did in the US. Some of that, of course, went to savings, but other was spent as well. So that was one of the reasons why the retail sector was a little stronger than some were seeing. But, you know, if you look carefully, it's not really a very, very strong story. And, you know, ahead, they're still not agreed on more stimulus. You know, there's a call for it, and of course the markets are banking on it, so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I don't know what your perspective is as to whether the result of the election is important one way or the other in terms of the economic perspective. I know it is politically, and I know it is if you like from a sort of position of behaviors and those sorts of things, but I wonder whether it will make much difference economically.
I think it's going to make a significant difference, to be honest, because it just depends on exactly how the makeup emerges. Because Trump is Trump, for a start, you know, and if he does lose, you don't know what he's going to do next. You don't know if he's going to be vindictive and he's just going to continue to withhold stimulus or what exactly he's going to do. You don't know. Trump's the wild card. You know, that's part of his appeal, you know, and it's part of the drawbacks of someone like him being in the White House. But then there's also, you know, if you get down to the sort of battleground states in the Senate, you know, there's some very, very close races in there, places like North Carolina, places like Iowa that are looking very, very close, you know, could go either way depending on how voter turnout, you know, ends up on the day. And obviously there's the early voting and all that, all the postal votes and everything, which could create all sorts of chaos and fun for everyone from the man in the street to the Supreme Court. So, but if we do see a Biden presidency and Trump continues to withhold stimulus till he's finally out of office in January of next year, it's going to take time for committee members to be chosen, for the various, you know, the slow wheels of Congress to turn until where they can go, okay, this is our appropriations committee, this is our that committee, et cetera, et cetera. And all that needs to be done before they can approve a stimulus plan. So it's conceivable that if Trump withholds stimulus and Mitch McConnell continues to be in charge of the, you know, majority leader in the Senate, who's a Republican, for those of you who may not be familiar with him, if that occurs, it's entirely possible that it could be February or March before we finally see some stimulus come through. And if McConnell wants to play hardball, it could be only maybe a third or maybe two-thirds of the size of what the market is talking about, or perhaps even less. We don't know. And it's really just that wild card, because if the Republicans take Trump's defeat, you know, and obviously this is a hypothetical scenario, but if the Republicans take Trump's defeat as a sort of rejection of populism, and they go back to the sort of, you know, fiscal conservatism, you know, the popularity of the Tea Party, holding, you know, stopping the Democrats from spending too much money, doing all that sort of stuff. If they decide that that's what they want to do, then we could see a big flip in Washington. We could see it go back to the sort of the Obama era days where they're very, very tight on the purse strings. And if that happens, the markets are not going to like it.
Mm. Well, it'd be interesting. You know, I've been reading a bit on this as well, and some people are saying that basically the Republican Party has got to a point doctrinally that it's going to be quite hard for them to come back from. You know, and some of it's obviously driven by you know, Trump's behavior himself, but actually doctrinally they also are you know, more on the sort of the big stimulus and you know, the tax cuts and those sorts of things. So I don't know. I mean, I can't perhaps read as precisely how it's going to go. But what I can say is that, you know, there are three scenarios, isn't there? There's going to be a clear winner on one side, a clear winner on the other side, or this fogginess in the middle where nobody's really quite sure who's won, and that could go on for a long, long time. If that is the scenario, in other words, if we really have no clarity for maybe a few days or maybe even a few weeks, that could also be very disruptive to the markets too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I believe it was in North Carolina, the Supreme Court recently ruled that votes received up till, I believe it was the 11th of November, will be counted. And North Carolina is shaping up to be a very, very close run thing. And it could very well go down to North Carolina being the deciding state in the election. So, I mean, if that happens, things could get really interesting for the market quite quickly once all the other votes are counted.
Mm. And, you know, what, again, is quite clear is that if there is that sort of middle ground, you know, clearly Trump isn't going to go quietly, and we'll do whatever he can to sort of to cling on by his fingernails. So yeah, I was speaking to somebody who's watching the US markets quite closely, and you know, his perspective was, well, they're hanging on one side for some stimulus to sort of just keep the ship afloat. And his perspective was, watch the Fed. Maybe the Fed will do some stuff to try and actually calm the markets and keep them up again, right? More of the same old, same old. It's an interesting and rather complex situation.
It is, because there's also, I mean, I believe it was George Gammon who was putting the idea out there on Twitter that, you know, that Steve Mnuchin could basically just draw down the TGA, which is the Treasury General Account, which has some ungodly amount of money. I believe it's about $1.6 trillion sitting in there. And if the government doesn't do any more borrowing, then that makes QE more difficult for the Fed to do, because there's basically no new bonds to buy. So if that does occur, Trump could be a real, you know, well, I mean, it depends. I mean, personally, I think the whole thing's a bit stupid. The whole QE thing's a bit dumb, and it's a complete waste of time and money. So in that, I suppose I agree with him. But, you know, just purely from the market's perspective, you could see them draw down the Treasury General Account over that time. There's no need to borrow until next year. $1.6 trillion is more than enough money to keep them going. So, I mean, realistically, it is possible that they just go, nah, sorry, Jerome. We're not issuing any more bonds. We're just going to run down the TGA, and you can just sit there in the corner and do nothing. If you don't like it, too bad.
Well, it shouldn't be interesting. And, you know, maybe we'll see some different strategies from the Fed, but, you know, you wonder what else they can do. But in a way, you know, there's an interesting compare and contrast, right? Because it's clear now that the Reserve Bank here on Tuesday is going to take that rate down as low as it can do. It's going to try and drive the long-term yield curve down by more of its market operations. It's going to be giving more forward guidance, all of that stuff. And obviously the argument is, well, if you take rates further down, that means that lending is cheaper. The question, of course, is, yeah, lending could be cheap, but is there enough demand for the credit that's there? Because the statistics came out today from both the Reserve Bank and from APRA, And, you know, there was a very little uptick from the RBA in terms of lending for housing, only a little bit up. Interestingly, the APRA number was actually also up for own occupation, but way down for investors, whereas, in fact, the RBA number was slightly up for investors too. But the overall credit, if you put it all together, is now sitting on an annualized 2% growth, which is lower than it's ever been. So there isn't a lot amount of evidence to suggest that people are actually willing and able to borrow more at the moment.
Well, as much as, you know, all the spruikers and all that, all those various things in the media would like to be able to say, look at housing, this is doing better. And yes, by the RBA statistics, it is doing a bit better. That's absolutely true. But if you look at the business credit, it's awful.
Yep.
It's absolutely awful. This is the longest run of month-on-month decreases in business credit since the financial crisis, according to the RBA's data. And if you cut out that big 3% increase which occurred in March, which was driven largely by big business drawing down lines of credit, the businesses are going nowhere. Businesses are going backwards at a million miles an hour. So without businesses borrowing to expand, to employ, to do all these various different things that grows the economy in an organic and sustainable way, you're not going anywhere, you know. And especially if you look at, even if you look at the numbers for the ABS payrolls for medium and small businesses, they're getting absolutely smashed while large businesses are doing quite well. So, I mean, it's really just like this two-speed economy. It's all well and good for people to say, oh, but look at retail, look at this, look at that. And it's like, when you throw $100 billion at an economy, that's what happens. People spend it. Mm. But what happens when you take the $100 billion away?
Yep. Yeah, and just to remind people, you know, there's a significant drop this quarter. There's even a same significant drop next quarter. So effectively, the total stimulus is definitely tapered down into next year. And, you know, the question is, will the normal economy, quote unquote, be able to come back and basically fill the void? And at the moment, doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that's to be the case. Certainly in my surveys, big business is actually a little bit more positive, you know, and the confidence levels are higher. But in the small business sector, we've still got close to one third of businesses who are worrying about their future and are saying, well, you know, there's really no a reason for me to invest in my business because I'm just trying to hang on until I see what's going to happen. And it's the small business sector, of course, which tends to be some of the more innovative and some of the more creative businesses that hopefully will grow into bigger businesses later. So if they're not firing, that's a big deal.
No, I agree. And to be honest, I read all these, you know, articles, I see these things on the news, spruiking, all this stuff. And I come back to the numbers. You know, it all comes back to the numbers for me. I mean, if you look at the latest data from Treasury, it showed about 1,300 businesses a day applying for JobKeeper.
Yep.
Across Australia. So that in based on Treasury's numbers for the average number of workers on a company that's receiving JobKeeper, you're looking at somewhere around about 5,000 new workers a day.
Right. And just to be clear, that is still happening, right? So
yeah.
So the idea of the demand for JobKeeper tailing away is actually completely offset by all of these new businesses coming on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, you're talking about probably 140,000 new recipients a month.
Yep.
And that's at a time this is based on my data, but when they did the estimates at the start of August, there was 3.5 million recipients on JobKeeper. Since then, my estimates showed between then and the 8th of October, which was the latest figures from Treasury, I estimate that maybe about another 400,000 to 400, and I think it was about 420,000 new recipients in that time, yep, based on Treasury's numbers.
Yep.
So realistically, by now, you're probably looking at around about 4 million on JobKeeper. Now, the government claims that unemployment's going to peak at 8%, which means they estimate that at most 150,000 jobs are going to be lost when JobKeeper concludes. And I'm just sitting here and I'm just thinking, so you guys are saying that less than 4% of JobKeeper recipients are going to lose their jobs. Do you in at any way just understand how absolutely absurd that sounds? Because I think we've discussed this before, because that either means that A, JobKeeper is an enormous waste of money and we've pissed away billions for nothing, or their numbers are completely wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I've just run the stress analysis for October, right? And that includes taking account of JobKeeper and JobSeeker, because I actually put those numbers into my model. And last month, the overall stress just dropped below 40%, right? Now, do you think it's gone up or down since then?
I would imagine it's gone up, considering the withdrawal of all that money.
Yeah, it has. It's gone up by at least 2%, which is higher than it's ever been. So I'm seeing the evidence of the withdrawal of stimulus and the withdrawal of JobSeeker and JobKeeper, plus the same data you're pointing to, an uplift in business in people actually requiring JobKeeper. So all of that is actually signaling, again, more pressure ahead. So this isn't actually out the woods. We're just actually beginning to start to see the next wave of impacts, in my view. And I expect to see that to continue to worsen up till Christmas. So again, another data point that suggests that we aren't out of the woods either.
No. And I think it's very interesting just looking at all the various data points and just seeing the gulf between some of them. You know, you've got the ANZ Confidence Index, which is worlds apart from the Westpac one, Completely different worlds. One, you know, Westpac says we've got the best confidence in nearly 3 years.
Ah, but one's sentiment and one's confidence. Discuss.
Because there's so much different. Because, you know, the people who do the survey perceive sentiment and confidence so differently. It's just interesting, you know. And then I look at like the ABS payrolls, you know, They're down even after the revisions. We've lost about 100,000 jobs in the last 2 weeks of figures.
Yep.
You know, you look at Roy Morgan's figures, you know, we've lost 56,000 jobs, and this is for September, not for October. And we've had 150,000 people leave the workforce. I don't know how you can write a spruiking article when you've got this data sitting next to you and you go, no, things are going to get better next year. Like I read one today. It's like, oh, you know, strengthening employment and the strengthening economy by mid-year. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Seriously. You know, I mean, even under the government's rosy assumptions, you're looking at about 1.2 to 1.5 million people transitioning off JobKeeper in April next year. If even a fraction of those people, if even 10% of people lose those jobs, unemployment's going to rise by over 1%, like that. You know, and then there's the insolvency moratorium and everything else. But, you know, let's just forget about all that. We'll just ScoMo will wave his magic wand. Everything will be fine. And we just don't need to worry about it.
Well, I have to say that a lot of the writers who are talking about this stuff don't really go into any great detail with regard to the statistics. So it's sort of a meta analysis, right, which is more about this is what I think rather than anything else, and it's not really supported by any data. That does seem to be the way that journalism is going largely at the moment.
Well, I suppose that, but the thing is, a lot of these people, to be completely honest with you, they're not actually journalists.
Right.
A lot of them are quite literally property spruikers. You know, you read the thing and it's like, oh, this is such and such. They work for property, right. You know, and okay. But by the same token, I mean, to defend my profession just a little bit for a change. I mean, journalists report what we're told, you know? Like if we go in and we interview three people and they all say property's going to rise, then that's what people write, you know? Yep. I mean, sure, there are people like me who basically just go off and do what we like, but you know, I'm very, very lucky to be able to do that. I have editors that let me basically do what I want. And I think people need to sort of keep in mind that that's a very rare thing and very lucky freedom I enjoy.
Yes. Well, I certainly have spoken to a number of journalists who concede to me that whatever their personal view is of the data that they're actually looking at the moment, they have to take the party line. And, you know, that then colours the way that they present the information, which I think is just, you know, it's worth just for people thinking about when they read something, who wrote it, what masthead was it under, and what are the connections of that masthead, right? Because that might actually inform some of the reasons why the article is the way it is. But, you know, the property spruiking is now, you know, well, it was probably 11, you know, to quote a phrase some time ago. It's probably about 15 now. I mean, I've never heard it so high. But what's also interesting is that the transparency in terms of the transactions that are actually being written at the moment is continuing to fall. I'm getting very... interesting stories of people who've actually asked agents about recent transactions in their area, and the agents are refusing to give them any information.
And that's something that I've seen in my own data with the number of auction prices being withheld. You know, that's been going on now for months. You know, you've seen it just shoot right back up to levels consistent with falling prices that we were seeing last year. And just while we're on the topic of the sort of the meta way they perceive the market. It's incredibly narrowly focused on Australia, on that nothing that's going on in the outside world is going to affect us. And I mean, like, I was reading this analysis the other day, and you know, from Europe, and they're saying that even though the central banks are literally paying the banks, offering them lower, you know, negative interest rates to borrow, so they're paying the banks to lend to people to buy houses in Europe, and the banks aren't doing it. They're tightening credit.
Yep.
In continental Euro.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, so this tightening of credit that's going on in Canada, the UK, in Europe, in the US, in Asia, all across the world, isn't going to affect us. We're not going to get impacted by this whole issue with high yield bonds and bondholders being wiped out down to maybe 1 or 2 cents in terms of their final return when a bond goes bust. All these things that are currently having issues on repricing credit in the bond market, you know, and then there's obviously all the various geopolitical issues that are going on with Australia and China and everything else. And we'll just ignore all that. None of that matters, because they're gonna cut responsible lending standards. That's what matters. Not everything else.
Yes. Well, there is certainly a air of splendid isolation here. And you know, the other perspective, of course, is that with the virus still raging in the US and now across Europe, the chances of international travel opening up anytime soon just gets further and further out. And Australia is pretty reliant on some of those. And, you know, they're talking about, well, maybe we can create some travel bubbles with, you know, China or whatever. But, you know, that's getting more and more complicated. And I reckon the first time that we see an uptick of infections in Australia because that was open, it'll get shut again. So it seems to me that that's something else to bear in mind. And then the other interesting thing is, if you look at the ANZ results this week, which is, you know, a fascinating microcosm of what's happening within banking, the net margins are significantly under pressure. They've had to put significant provisions aside. They're signalling they're going to focus very much on cost cutting ahead as effectively their growth engine. Which basically means more unemployment, by the way. Cost-cutting means losing people. And, you know, you look hard at what they're saying about the trajectory ahead, and it looks to me as though they're not expecting a huge bounce back in lending. So, but once again, let's not let information get in the way of a good story.
I sort of look at the banks a bit of the same way I looked at China in January and February. Look at what they're doing, not at what they're saying.
No.
You know, like they can talk a big game. They can talk about, you know, well, we're going to get unemployment down to 7% really soon, and everything's going to be fine, and JobKeeper's going to disappear, and everything's going to be hunky dory. But if that was the case, they wouldn't be laying off staff. No. They wouldn't be adding more staff in terms of their bad loans divisions. They'd be taking a very, very, very different tact. Now they can say, "Oh, we're just being prudent." But I mean, I've got a little thing about called the Royal Commission I'd like to talk to you about that I think fairly well covered the bank's attitude towards prudency.
Yeah, well, prudency is you know, relative, I suppose. And I don't know whether you saw the ASIC and APRA discussions in estimates this week, but you know, Wayne Byres was in front of estimates, and basically he admitted that he had been told by the treasurer that they were going to basically wheel back the ASIC powers. ASIC weren't told, right? So ASIC found out later, right? And it's like, well, okay, as long as we have financial stability fixed because of what APRA is doing, we don't need to worry about what it means for individuals. And this whole idea of swinging the power back so that effectively, you know, individuals should take the responsibility for the loans they take rather than the banks being asked to take responsibility. And so, this is a quote, reduces the risks, right? Well, hang on a moment. Which risks are we reducing? We're reducing the risks of perhaps being people suing the banks for bad lending practices. but we're putting more risks back on individuals who are really in an unequal situation when they come to actually get a loan. It just seems to me that we've lost the plot.
Well, I mean, the fact that ASIC found out from the news media is just ridiculous. I mean, Jesus. And not only that, but Josh Frydenberg, if, you know, depending on what happens with these various sort of internal reviews and stuff going on at ASIC, it's possible that Josh Frydenberg might be picking the next head of ASIC. And I'm just sitting here and I'm going, what happened, man? Yeah. What happened? You know, what? Josh Frydenberg, I'm not going to say anything about Josh Frydenberg because I don't want to get in trouble. But all I can say is that photo with Kenneth Hayne sums it up. And perhaps you can put that up on the screen for everyone. That sums up what Josh Frydenberg's attitude is towards the banks and towards systemic risk, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, well, that's right. And if you stand back, right, if you think about the last 10 years, right, the banks have basically been able to create superior profits because they've been lending for mortgages rather than to the business sector, right? They've been basically protected with, very low rates on support from the Reserve Bank recently. They've now basically been protected and insulated from all the findings from the Royal Commission, other than AMP, who looks like might get swallowed up by a speculator. So we've got a protected species here of the banks, right? And you have to say that the banks and the government seem to be dancing the very same tune.
But are they, though? That's something that I think is quite interesting. Like, there's this whole perception that once they deregulate lending standards, the banks are going to go back to the Wild West and everything's going to pick up again. And that there's this idea out there, especially in the property area, that they're like, no, everything's going to be Wild West. Everything, they're going to be lending like crazy. It's all going to be fantastic. But in my discussions with the banks, and even in some of the things that they've been saying publicly, which obviously you take with a pinch of salt because it's, you know, everyone's talking in their own book. But I don't really see that there's a whole lot there for them to just go completely Wild West lending on out of nowhere. I don't think they're idiots. You know, ANZ are predicting, you know, so just to go back to the ANZ example, they're predicting unemployment that's still going to be 8.8% at the end of 2021.
Yep.
They're predicting that only 1.6% growth in 2021, which is nothing. It's really just quite poor, to be completely honest. And that doesn't sound like a sort of atmosphere that where ANZ, say ANZ specifically, is going to turn around and go, you know what, all you people who didn't qualify for loans before, we're going to give you loans now. No, I don't think that they're that silly. To be honest, if we do get to a point where some way, somehow, all of this works out for the best, we get a vaccine and some other things go our way, and then the economy is going better, unemployment's heading for 5%, then the Wild West could happen, sure. But like this, I don't really see it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you know, what I can say is that the tighter APRA guidance, which is tighter than it was, I should say, and I guess we should give them some kudos for that, has put a dampener on what they can do, because they have to be able to show from a risk portfolio management perspective that they actually know what they're doing, right? So that's the first point. But the second point is that, again, it's clear that lending standards are not being loosened and won't necessarily be loosened in the current environment. Now, okay, repayment rates are lower and that helps a little bit at the margin, but there are other factors that people have to take account of. And the other interesting thing I've noticed from my consumer surveys is that more consumers are actually getting more sassy about how much they should borrow rather than how much they could borrow, right? So maybe a little bit of what we're doing on this channel and other channels is helping to allow people to understand that just because a bank says, sure, you can have the loan, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing.
No, I think that raises an interesting point, because we're seeing this sort of shift in consumer behavior. I mean, it's really quite interesting, because I feel like it's shifted in two completely different directions. Because on one hand, you've got the wealthy going out and going absolutely ape, buying anything from, you know, sort of classic cars to, you know, 50-year-old toys for, you know, 20 times what they were worth not all that long ago. And then on the other hand, you've got people who are less well off, who you know, you see their confidence is still down in the dumps, in the doldrums, who are being a lot more careful and a lot more circumspect. Because I mean, I suppose really that's to be expected. I mean, you know, we've got something like 4 million people on JobKeeper. If those people weren't reassessing their capabilities and reassessing their personal and, you know, household finances, I mean, I suppose there would be something wrong, wouldn't there?
Well, they certainly would, and they are. I'd also make the point that a large number of households are quite dependent on income from savings in deposit accounts, right? And those rates have been taken down. Again, CBA announced another rate cut today for deposit holders, right? And there's been a consistent pattern in the last few weeks of rates coming down, 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 and ever more down, to the point where many people now are not getting any income at all from money sitting in savings accounts. And that begs an interesting question, of course, because what will that do? Will that actually get to the point where people say, well, there's no point in me keeping money in the bank because I don't get anything for it. So I either go and spend it on something, and maybe that's what the Reserve Bank is after, or they might just pull the notes out and just hold them in a safe somewhere. And, you know, somebody drew my attention to a recent report that said that there are more high-value notes in circulation, well, high notes issued but not in circulation, than ever in the past. That might give us a clue as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think it also just, like, I mean, in my discussions with financial advisors, you know, talking to people who are in this position now where their shares are no longer providing the same dividends. You know, say, for example, like ANZ, they cut their dividend from $1.60 a share down to 60 cents. You know, so basically some people have seen their incomes drop by, you know, a third, two-thirds, you know, quite substantial knocks. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, we're all sort of pretty clear on the fact that's not going to, that the previous level of dividends for the banks is unlikely to be resuming in the next, say, 12 to 18 months.
Yeah.
You know, so there are a lot of retiree households, you know, self-funded retirees who maybe have an investment property or two, who are sitting on these properties that are earning bugger all. You know, like, okay, they're earning something, but then there's all the hassle of running it, the hassle of tenants, etc. You know, it's all sort of too hard basket for some people, especially as they get older, and that's perfectly understandable. They just want to get on with their lives. But it's really quite interesting looking at that perspective, because what they're saying to me is that a lot of them are considering offloading these properties. So it's really something that I think is going to be quite interesting, because we've seen housing turnover drop significantly in recent years. You know, housing turnover is down near 30-year lows, or perhaps even longer. I don't actually have the time series that goes back beyond that. And it sort of leads me to the sort of conclusion that there is quite a lot of pent-up supply waiting for an improvement in prices, or waiting for a clear signal to pull the trigger. And I'm just wondering, is that something that you're seeing in your household surveys?
Absolutely, I am, yes. And there are two particular cohorts. The first is property investors. So a lot of property investors are seeing the rental returns just falling and falling and falling, or are vacant. You know, some of the inner city rentals are just vacant at the moment, and we've got huge vacancy rates. Elsewhere, people are able to relet them, but at a much lower rent. And that's true as you move out into the outer suburban areas. And if you look at the mix of property for sale at the moment, what's rising is apartments. So the skew between houses and apartments is getting more extreme. So there are more of those. Second data point is that in my conversations with some of the real estate agents, they are deliberately holding off listing some properties. So if there are three or four or five properties that are in the same block and, you know, everybody wants to sell, what they're trying to do is sell them sequentially rather than putting all five on the market at the same time, because they know that if they do that, the prices are going to fall. So there are quite a few estate agents now who are actually trying to manipulate that part of the cycle so to keep the prices up a little higher. And then the final point is worth just highlighting, that some of the people who are buying new properties are actually buying them from developers who are giving them $100,000 back post the transaction. So the purchase price that they actually are citing in the settlement data is about $100,000 above what the real value exchange was, right? And that's a way of, again, masking what's going on. And the thing I want to come to is there's so much masking of information, there's so much obfuscation that's going on. It is really, really hard for people to really understand where things really are. And, you know, my surveys help to cast a bit of a spotlight on some of the dynamics. But there is very, poor information readily available to many people who are trying to make, frankly, decisions which will impact their life for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, exactly right. It's just something that's really interesting. Like, you're talking about, like, the obfuscation, you know, the sort of opaqueness of all this, of the way all this is working. And it's, I find it really interesting. I find that the one of the, perhaps the most interesting one of all is Melbourne.
Yep.
Because, you know, as your surveys have shown, as, you know, basically every, you know, right-wing politician has been shouting to high heavens for the last, you know, 3 months, Melbourne has gone to hell, you know, and that's true. There are a lot of people are struggling very, very badly. You know, a lot of people are going to lose their houses, you know, have their businesses closed. And that is obviously a disaster, and it's a tragedy for these people. But looking at things from a broader overview, and I mean, obviously, you're someone who's very familiar with how all this works, but is that not something that's going to drive a tightening in credit? Just because there's going to be so many problems in Melbourne. It's all well and good for all the banks to say, oh, no, prices aren't going to drop that much. But Melbourne is a disaster area more than basically any other city in the Western world, because it's had a longer lockdown and a more strict lockdown, and a lot of people are suffering.
Well, that's true. Yeah, the situation in Melbourne is pretty dire. I mean, there's a little bit of optimism now, of course, because the lockdown is coming away. But nevertheless, of course, a lot of damage has been done, and many people are still struggling with less hours or no hours and all that situations. That's going to take a long time to cure, and I think a lot of small businesses will just fold in the process. But the broader point is this, that I wonder who it is. And I think of, you know, across the ACCC or the Productivity Commission or whoever, who is actually sitting and thinking about this whole situation structurally, because I don't think anybody is, right? Because what we're actually doing is we're highlighting a whole bunch of issues that are suggesting that the property market and, you know, the finance system is really cooked. I mean, it's what it's done is basically designed and structured to try and get a certain degree of outcomes which are actually in line with political aspirations and, you know, financial aspirations from the Reserve Bank and things, at the expense of ordinary people. And the information that you would need to make rational decisions is not available. That's a crooked market, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. But, I mean, I suppose that the thing is we are literally at a point now where either property prices rise or it all falls over. It's that simple. No, I mean, it is. It's that simple,
yep.
You know?
Yep.
You know, I mean, with so many people in the sort of older demographics, with so many property investors in precarious situations due to, you know, unemployment or cut hours or any other number of reasons, you know, all of that is leading to the situation where property prices either rise or it all falls over to some degree. Yep. To what degree, I don't know. It depends on government intervention, etc. But I think that really speaks volumes to where we are at the moment, because the government's caught between a rock and a hard place. They either, you know, they either save it or they don't. And, yeah, you know, not saving it has big consequences, but saving it also has consequences as well. There are costs regardless of what they do.
Yeah. Well, there's a thing called dance macabre, and we've come across it, but the idea is you've got to keep dancing, because if you stop dancing, you die. And that's what I think we're actually in, right? So we've got to keep the property dance going. And, you know, keep switching, keep getting more people to buy, keep lending more, because as soon as we actually realize where we are and stop, then the whole thing goes, wah, right? And the more we continue to dance, the longer we dance for, the more exhausted we become, the more difficult it is to continue to dance, the more you have to sort of, you know, throw more stuff in to try and keep the dance going. But at some point, I'm still of the view, at some point, that's going to actually get to the point where it just says, oh, it's too hard. And I just cannot see from where we are, even with all the stimulus that people are talking about and the Reserve Bank and everything else, I can't see how that is going to be able to continue indefinitely. At some point, the dance is going to stop.
In all likelihood, I would imagine so. I mean, it's just interesting. I do wonder where it all ends. What exactly are they willing to do? What exactly are they willing to destroy in order to save this? Because that's what they're doing. They're destroying things. They're destroying the balance of the budget. JobKeeper was a complete waste of money. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have done something to insulate things, and we shouldn't have used that money to help save jobs and help protect the economy. Of course we should. But I'm just saying the form that it took was a waste of money. Now, Well, it's true. Look at Q2's corporate profits. You know, I mean, you look at the rest of the world; they're all dropping. Here, they're rising. You know, it was a waste. Yep. You know, I mean, you know, Solomon Liu doesn't need a new private jet. Okay, you know, that really sums it up, in my opinion. But it's like, okay, so they've destroyed the budget. They've destroyed their ideology of fiscal conservatism, of any pretense of that whatsoever. Now, I understand that there needed to be some sort of, shall we say, you know, a hiatus on that, but they haven't. That's not what they've done. They've completely smashed it to pieces, and a lot of people are quite annoyed about that within the Liberal Party, I might add. And you know, and they've not only that, now they're talking about dismantling lending standards. They're doing all these different things that is basically just slowly but surely, you know, undermining the country for the long term. And I don't know. I mean, I wrote an article for Independent Australia earlier this week, and it's insane to think that we're going to potentially live in a nation where, if we are wrong, and they do manage to, you know, light a fire under property and it all skyrockets for the next couple of years, whereby we're going to have real, in all likelihood, double digit unemployment once you factor in all the people who left the labour force. For a long time, some of whom are going to be young people who are out of uni, who are struggling to get a job, all the while they're going to be sitting there watching property prices skyrocket. And I mean, that to me is a failed society.
Yep. And by the way, look at New Zealand, because they're going down the same route as well, I should add. But what's interesting again is, well, who's protected? You know, who is effectively, you know, on the inside, as it were? Because I still think a lot of these policies are all about bank keeper, you know, protecting the banking system, protecting financial stability at all costs, which is the sort of the code for protecting the banks, at the expense of ordinary Australians. And that's the reason why I come back to the fact that this can't necessarily get us to where we need to get to as a country, as we've discussed before, I suppose. But, you know, it'll take some time to play out, and I suspect that we will still see a lot more spruiking for the next few months, even in the face of all the evidence as it comes out.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a few points there. Like, I mean, just say, for example, with the banks, they're destroying the banking system of Australia gradually. You know, by taking rates so low, by engaging in all these, you know, things to drive down rates, they are effectively slowly destroying the profitability of our banking system. We've seen that in Europe. We're starting to see that to a degree in America, and obviously all these various cheap funding things for the RBA are designed to sort of cushion that blow. But it's something that over time is going to diminish the profitability of our banking sector. It's not something that's going to occur overnight. It's something that's going to occur over years and perhaps even decades, but it is something that's going to undermine a sort of, well, shall we say, an engine of growth for the, you know, for the economy. And I suppose, you know, all those retirees out there sitting on those bank shares that they just absolutely love.
Yeah. Well, the banks have been a very large proportion of the stock market performance and, you know, the rental, the income streams from dividends for a long, long time. That's changing. On the other hand, if you talk to businesses who are trying to get a loan, they can't. And unfortunately, taking these rates down won't necessarily make it easier for businesses to get loans either. So, you know, it is a myopic approach designed for one particular set of outcomes, which is to protect the banks and to protect the property system to be able to get past the next election. But it's not necessarily laying the foundations for a productive an economically sustainable society, unfortunately. That's just, I guess, where we are. Well, as we come to the end of this conversation, Tariq, I need to come back to the big US question. Have you got a sense of which way it's going to land?
Oh, God. Well, this is probably going to come back to haunt me one way or another. But I think it's going to be close, as I shared that map on Twitter, which, you know, which a lot of people saw. I think it's going to be very, very close.
Yep.
I think it's going to be a relatively drawn out outcome. I mean, I just saw that today in Florida that apparently early voting is favoring Republicans.
Yep.
56 to 40 to 43.
Yeah.
And but except that the Democrats are winning postal votes. So I'm gonna go out on the limb here, and I'm gonna say there is a strong possibility that there could be a very tight Trump victory.
Yeah. Interesting, because that's pretty much where I've landed. I could be wrong, and you know, I'm happy to be proved wrong, but I just think that we'll see not on the night. I think it's going to take some time to work through, but I think it's going to be a way lot closer than a lot of the pundits are talking about.
Us agreeing on something that's out of the ordinary, that never happens, does it? Us going against the curve.
Oh, well, I'll have to change my position quick. Tarek, I appreciate your time today. As always, very interesting and love your perspectives. And we'll catch up again soon. I guess we'll compare notes after the election if we don't know the result.
Yeah, well, we certainly will, mate. I'm looking forward to it.
See ya.